This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
We'll talk to Matt Llewellyn and Craig Hershiser coming up in 10 minutes. It's your high school whip around here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. So NCAA President Mark Emmert released a statement earlier this afternoon and announced that the NCAA Board of Governors and Division I Board of Directors will be forming a commission on college basketball. It will be headed by Condoleezza Rice. There's some notable names in there, including David Robinson, Grant Hill, Notre Dame president, John Jenkins, and Ohio State athletic director Gene Smith, the guy who formerly at Iowa State hired both Tim Floyd and Larry Eustachy. So these are the types of guys that are going to be tasked with cleaning up college basketball and rooting out what Emmert refers to as the culture of silence in college basketball that enables bad actors. We need them out of the game. Emmert says we must take decisive action. This is not a time for half measures or incremental change. Now, the commission, according to Emmert, will be focused on three areas. Those three areas are, one, the relationship of the NCAA National Office, member institutions, student-athletes, and coaches with outside entities, including apparel companies, non-scholastic basketball, which would be like AAU, and agents or advisors, with an emphasis on how students and their families can get legitimate advice without being taken advantage of. So that's number one. The relationship with the NCAA and all of these outside entities. Number two thing that they're going to focus on is the NCAA's relationship with the NBA and challenging effect the NBA's so-called one-and-done rule and what impact it's had on college basketball, including NCAA eligibility rules to address that dynamic. So that's number two. Number one, the NCAA's relationship with outside entities. Number two, the NCAA's relationship with the NBA. And three, creating the right relationship between the universities and colleges of the NCAA and its national office to promote transparency and accountability. It will begin its work in November, and Emmert adds that he believes that we can and we must find a way to protect the integrity of college sports by addressing both sides of the coin, fairness and opportunity for college athletes, coupled with the enforcement capability to hold accountable those who undermine the standards of our community, end quote. Now, this seems a little, it seems a little silly from the aspect of, after everything that's going on, and there hasn't been anything that has necessarily implicated the NCAA, but I think it's a little lacking in transparency to not take any accountability in this from the NCAA point of view. Like, saying that you haven't enabled anything that has been going on in college basketball. Now, with that being said, is there opportunity here to actually improve the sport? No question. There's no question about it, but if they want to do it, if the NCAA really wants to improve college basketball and make things better, they're going to have to face some hard truths. They're going to have to face some hard truths about what is actually going on in college basketball. This can't be half and half. He said we're not going to take any half measures. All right. I'm happy to hear that. If you're not going to take any half measures, then you have to be willing and ready to admit what is actually going on in college basketball and taking responsibility from the NCAA point of view as to how much of this is kind of on yourself. The first one, you have allowed Adidas and Nike and Under Armour and all of these different shoe companies to organize their own feeder tournaments that directly impact kids' ability to get scholarships. You have to do away with that. You cannot give these apparel companies these tournaments in high school, these AAU tournaments that give these companies direct access to these kids. I think that's step number one, is you have to kind of take control of that. Because if you don't, then this kind of shady business under the table is always going to be happening.
I have a big problem with a part of the committee. You're talking about trying to mend this relationship between the student athletes, the apparel companies, whatever else you want to talk about. Their, I guess, latest college graduate of that group is Grant Hill. He graduated college in 1994. So yes, you're talking about a guy who was a first-round draft pick. He came into a big-time college basketball school. He went through the ringer of being recruited, having to go around these different apparel companies. But that was 20, I mean, by the time he was recruited, that would have been 26, 27 years ago. How much of a relationship do those guys have, those people in that committee, with what's actually going on now? Don't you think it would have best behooved them a little bit more to go out and get somebody who graduated maybe 5-10 years ago, knows the landscape a little bit more, and is a little more recent to it?
Yeah, I'd like to think that these guys are going to be able to figure out exactly what's going on. I'd like to think they're not all like completely out of touch with what's happening in today's modern, you know, youth and college basketball. But you hear Emmert mention the one-and-done rule, and that is a rule that is implemented by the NBA as a part of their collective bargaining agreement. So I don't know how much control the NCAA really has. Now, maybe they can put in a good word, but the NBA likes it that they get an extra year to scout these players before they have to sign them to multi-million dollar contracts. But I mean, that's got to be on the table, is to take away the one-and-done rule. I think it certainly helps college basketball. I think it's great for the sport in itself, and that you get some of the most talented players from the high school ranks to come and be a part of your sport for a year, but it's not good for these kids, and it's part of the problem as to why these kids are getting paid under the table. And kind of hand in hand with that, it is well past time for the NCAA to start ceding some ground on letting these kids profit off their name, profit off their likeness, profit off their image. All right? We cannot continue to go along here and act like there are ways to fix this problem without changing how these kids are compensated for their time and for their efforts. There's just no way around it. You can come up with as many different formulas or algorithms as to how we can fix this while not changing that, but I'm telling you, it's never going to work. There are always going to be people who are willing to break the rules to get these kids money because it behooves them to do so, because it will help them in the long run. As long as there is an excess of cash, these kids will find a way to get their hands on it. I think that is probably first and foremost amongst the things that the NCAA can fix and change if they really, really are dead set on improving this thing.
And I 100% agree with you, but knowing the NCAA, I would say they're going to fight tooth and nail. They're going to scratch as hard as they can to avoid this from happening.
But if you're going to put this committee together and you want everybody to be convinced that you are really, really focused on improving this and you have the best interests of the college basketball world, if that's what you want us to believe, then you have to have these conversations, as tough as they may be for you to have, as tough as it may be to admit that, yeah, we have not been doing this thing right and we need to change it now. You have to have them, because if you're not willing to have those conversations, then this is all pointless. If you're not willing to have those conversations, then we're wasting our time here and you're wasting your breath and your effort and your money putting this committee together if you're not willing to start with the root problems.
Wouldn't be the first time with the NCAA, though.
No, it wouldn't, but hopefully I'm not being naive to think that this time it's going to be different, because they haven't really faced a problem of this magnitude before. I said it 2 weeks ago, I'll say it again. If you really want to fix this, if you really want this to get better, then you can't keep doing the same things over and over again. All right? Like, this is a bad look for the NCAA. It's time to start doing things that we've been saying you should be doing for a long time. If you outlaw something, you're going to create outlaws. You can't just change the rules and expect those outlaws to go away. It's 329 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Four o'clock hour is upon us on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I'm Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. We will talk to the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis, coming up 10 minutes from right now. We've got your Wednesday news break coming up at 4:30, and we'll talk to Jesse Newell of the KC Star at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. The NCAA has created a committee headed by Condoleezza Rice, including President Mark Emmert, who made the announcement, as well as David Robinson, as well as Grant Hill, Notre Dame President John Jenkins, and the AD, Gene Smith, who hired Larry Eustace and Tim Floyd at Iowa State. And those guys both avoided any major controversies during their time in Ames. So I would probably peg Gene Smith as being a very solid judge of character. But again, like, you can talk about all of these things that you want to fix. You want to talk about the NCAA's relationship with the AAU, the NCAA's relationship with the NBA, and how the one-and-done rule impacts college basketball. And we can discuss all of these things, but if you're not focusing on the root of this problem, which, again, I try to explain it in as simple terms as possible, you have an excess of cash in college athletics because you have unpaid labor. And if you continue to have an excess of something, there is going to be a black market for it. And that black market is going to create interest upon those unpaid laborers to get their hands on that excess. You outlaw something, you create outlaws. And what has essentially happened with the NCAA, it's an old truck. It's a 98 Ford Lariat with 350,000 miles on it. And it broke down on the side of the road. Come to terms with the fact that your car, your truck, is cashed out. It's done. It's kaput. You need a new one. And you're sitting there because you love your truck so much. You're saying, "Well, maybe if I get the oil changed on it. Maybe if I put new windshield wiper fluid in it. Maybe that'll fix the problems." No. If you ain't got no rims, don't get no wood grain steering wheel. Okay. Focus on the right things here. Focus on the root of this problem. And I hope they do. I really do. And I believe they have the capacity to get it done. These are smart people. But these are also people who don't really have any real reason to fix this problem. Now, hopefully the FBI scared the NCAA straight, where they have to look at themselves in the mirror honestly and say, all right, these are the real problems. These are the root of the problems. Not stuff that is stemmed from it, but the actual root of the problem. You have to cut the head off the snake. And if the NCAA is not willing to do that, this seems like wasted effort. This seems like we're going to take months. This committee is going to implement some new rules that aren't really going to affect anything, but at least will show that they're trying. And I don't think that's what we should be doing here. Obviously, it's not what we should be doing here. I hope that this is going to implement some actual changes in college athletics, but I'm just not convinced it is.
I view this as a last-ditch effort from the NCAA to try to avoid crossing over into that line where we do hit a point where you're paying players, or at the very least, they're getting their own revenue based off their name and likeness, their jersey sales, things of that nature. I just view this as the NCAA trying to save grace. It looks good to the public eye just to say, hey, we're doing something about this now. We're creating a commission. Don't worry about whatever else is going on. We're going to be fine. We just needed to add some new things. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure this is going to work. I guess it's the right step, but based on prior knowledge of what the NCAA has done and how slow some of their processes work, I'm a bit skeptical about whether this is going to save grace on this whole idea of the FBI investigations.
Adidas paid Louisville $160 million for their athletic deal. And what was the news that came out last week, that Rick Pitino was receiving like 98% of that?
Yeah.
Now, the school gave it to him. It wasn't Louisville that paid it directly to Pitino, but they paid Louisville, and Louisville was giving 98% of that money directly to Rick Pitino. If you're Louisville, what would you rather do? Would you rather pay, or excuse me, if you're Adidas, what would you rather do? Would you rather pay Louisville $160 million, or would you rather say, hey, you've got this top five recruit, he's going to be in the NBA next year, how about we just sponsor him individually? We give him 5% of that $160 million, save a bunch of money, and pay the guys who are actually going to promote our brand, right? Like, that's what this comes down to. These are the fixes that need to be made to college basketball. And I have long said I don't have the answers to fixing this sport, to fixing college athletics. But there are a lot of people working in Indianapolis for the NCAA making 7-8 figures a year. They get paid handsomely. They are smart. They can figure it out. It's not my job to figure it out. It's not your job to figure it out. There are a lot of people who are being compensated to figure this kind of stuff out. And now, with this committee, You have a direct finger to point at the people who should be figuring this out. And if they don't, then it's wasted effort. I'm not saying the solutions are easy, because that seems to be a big wall that people want to put up. Well, you know, if you start paying players or you start letting them be compensated for their likeness, this whole thing gets really sticky, right? It gets really hairy. It's going to get really complicated. To steal a line from Jay Billis, corporations and companies all over the globe make complicated decisions every single day. What if they had a tough decision to make? What if Google had a tough decision to make? What if Apple had a tough decision to make and they said, you know what, we need to fix this problem, but it's going to be really complicated, so we'll just keep doing it. You'd say, what? No! Fix it! You're smart! You're rich! Like, you should be able to fix these problems. The NCAA contesting that it's going to be very difficult and hairy, like, that's not an excuse.
I mean, going off that point, if you want to add, like, another metaphor simile in there, every time there's a presidential election, what's one of the biggest talking points? The economy. How are you going to fix the economy? It's never, oh, you know what? It's kind of complicated. I'm not going to touch it.
Well, let's just stay away from that.
Yeah.
This is going to be really tough. We don't have the solution. Somebody can. Somebody can figure it out. A lot of smart people who are involved with the NCAA. Somebody can figure this out. And again, I want to keep reiterating, I hope they can do it. They have the power to do it. They have people smart enough in this committee to figure it out. But in order to get to that point, you have to have some difficult conversations. You have to have some conversations that involve you looking inward, looking in the mirror and saying, okay, what do we need to do differently? Not what kinds of rules do we need to implement to keep other people from breaking the rules. What about our system? What can we fix within ourselves to make this better? There are answers to that question, but you have to be willing to ask the question first. It's 413 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Let's switch gears, talk some Chiefs with The Voice, Mitch Holtis, coming up next. A lot of good teams in the NFL, but it seems like the Chiefs are even distancing themselves from that next pack with what they've done over the first five games.
Well, they can really do that now in the next one or two, especially with the difficulty that's there, not only in the opponent, but the logistics. Because you've got a 325 game Sunday at Arrowhead against Pittsburgh, and then you've got the dreaded Thursday night game, two time zones away at Oakland, which is, I think, the hardest thing to do in all of professional sports. But anyway, we've got what we've got, and it's an undefeated team with doing things that I have not seen any team do ever. That is, like, offensive. Like, my big thesis this week has been the golden triangle of offense. Third down percentage, red zone touchdown percentage, two-minute offense. The Chiefs are in the top four in all three categories, and that's never happened.
Well, and you look at what they did on Sunday night against Houston, especially on those first couple of drives early in that game. It was just third and long conversion, third and long conversion, third and six, a 23-yard play. They were all, whether it was DeMarcus Robinson or Tyreek Hill or Travis Kelce, you don't expect any team to be able to consistently convert in those third and long situations. But the Chiefs were doing it like it was nothing. Like, that's just what they do. And I think that kind of speaks to your point of, I don't expect to see that from any team, but we saw it with consistency on Thursday night, on Sunday night. And how would you expect to beat a team who you feel like you're stopping them on first down, you're getting them into these difficult conversion scenarios, and they just kept coming up time and time again?
Yeah, it's the most devastating thing you can do to a defense is that, because you're pretty confident you've got the offense off the field, and then that happens. The other thing the Chiefs were able to do in this game was answer. That's the other devastating thing, particularly to a home team that has momentum in the stadium. Houston had got it 26-20. The Chiefs drive 75 yards, 32-20. Go for two, don't make it. Stuff them, three and out. Get the ball back, and it's a punt return that, whoop, there goes Kareem Hunt for 82, and now all of a sudden it's 39-20. It was a fantastic answer to a team that was playing at home and thought they were hot in the game, and then the Chiefs just took the game from them, much like the New England game to open the season.
Why do teams continue to choose to let Tyreek Hill return punts?
Because Shane Lechler, he's an 18-year veteran. He may be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I don't know. It was his 31st game against the Chiefs. But it also shows you, don't ever take for granted ability to directional punt. Leckler can't do it. He tried to do it earlier in the game, and he skanked it like a 33-yard punt. So Leckler has just, all of his life, has just boomed it. Like, I'm just throw it up here. I'm going to hit it as hard as I can. And he can't directional punt. So he booms that punt beyond the coverage, and here comes Tyreek coming back at 23 miles an hour. It was the inability of the punter to do what he should do. I mean, it's not easy to do to say, hey, punt it out of bounds with high hang time at 43 yards, so no return. If you could find a punter that do that consistently, you pay him and keep him for 12 years like the Chiefs have done with Dustin Colquitt.
And Mitch, you know what's so funny is we were talking about the Patriots game after the fact, and it seemed like Bill Belichick was daring the rookie running back in his debut, Kareem Hunt, to beat him. And he did just that and then some. And now you fast forward 4 weeks, and it looked as though Houston's game plan was to stop Kareem Hunt, and they were doing that early. But it's got to be demoralizing when you have a game plan, you execute that game plan to an extent early in the game, and yet you still don't get any closer to pulling off the win, whether it was Alex Smith beating him over the top with Travis Kelce or on the outsides with Tyreek Hill. This is an incredibly difficult team to game plan for right now because it seems like nothing's working.
And guys are stepping up. Even the offensive line, Cameron Irving did a really good job at right guard filling in for the Canadian doctor. And Witzman's doing okay, but Zach Fulton's doing an amazing job at center. He would be starting, I think, for 25 other teams. And then the receivers you've already mentioned, the offensive guys filling in, they're going to have to do it again now that Conley's out for the season. But Demetrius Harris has played better. Albert Wilson's on another planet. And then if you can get Demarcus Robinson going with some consistency, it's really the old cliche, pick your poison. And I thought that's what Houston did. They were so sick of Kelce beating them up, you'd think, well, you'd pay attention to Kelce. But, he had 100 yards in the first half.
Yeah.
Because they decided, no, it's not going to be Kareem Hunt. Well, then it's going to be Kelce for a hundo at halftime. I mean, so goes back to our training camp reports. I think you'll know. This team has way more weapons than they've ever had. We were talking about that on August the 1st and August the 11th, not just October the 11th.
And now some guys are going to have to step up with Chris Conley out. Mm-hmm. And we always have the conversation about guys, you know, people on the outside trying to attribute who's having good seasons according to fantasy points. And Chris Conley hasn't put up big stat lines, but he has been out there a lot for the Chiefs, making big plays, I think playing more snaps than any other wide receiver on the team. Now you lose him for the season. Who does the onus kind of fall on to pick up the slack?
Well, there is no one. There's nobody to say. It's kind of like the Eric Berry answer. There's no, well, it's, you know, it's Nick Schwert. You're good. You're one for one. There's not in this instance. Just because Conley's a taller, more physical target, so he's more of your third down possession type receiver, which I told you in a training camp report that was the next step for him. Well, he had done it. The 2 years prior to this one, he had 32 targets on third down and 30 targets and only 12 conversions. Well, he was way up there this year, and now he's gone. And Albert Wilson's not that guy because he physically isn't Conley. So you're going to get a little Demarcus Robinson. I'm going to give you a unlikely candidate who may have to step up here and do it, and that's Ross Travis, the Penn State basketball tight end, and start thinking about him more like a receiver than being a tight end and helping fill in some of the gap.
You know, speaking of Ross Travis, he saw some increased playing time with Kelce out there in the second half. Just how carefully are they going to handle Kelce's concussion situation moving forward?
Very. Two reasons. The NFL protocol, obviously, but then they're going to be, I think the Chiefs are going to be even a little more cautious than the NFL requirement here. They want to make sure it's not a reoccurring thing or something that could, reoccur soon. And because they want this guy to say, this season could last 3.5 more months. We hope it does, or 4 more months. And they want him to be there for the duration. So Coach Reed's thinking not only short term, but long term with all of these decisions.
We're talking to the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis, here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. when seemingly everything's going right for a team, we have a tendency on the outside to create problems that they need to fix. And I guess this would be one of those good problems, but with Kareem Hunt being as effective as he's been the first five games of his career, is there going to be, and this is a question I know has popped up a lot, but is there going to be any focus on trying to limit his touches and trying to limit the wear and tear that he has to sustain over the rest of the season?
Let's go back to the way we began the discussion 15 minutes ago or so. He's probably the focal point. He and Derek Johnson, when do you rest him? When do you spell him? But you've already seen that to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing Sir-Kendrick West get a few touches. You're seeing them, either Tyreek Hill or De'Anthony Thomas or different players where they flipped the De'Anthony Thomas on that little bubble touchdown they ran. Andy Reid's trying to be very creative because he also wants Kareem Hunt to be there for the duration. But this stretch of the season, I'm going to tell you, Nick, this stretch of the season, more than any other, from now until November 1, will challenge that initiative the most because of your off schedule, and you've got this Sunday night, 3:15 to Thursday afternoon, which is just wicked.
And, you know, what's interesting about that is you look at the two teams who you expect to be there at the end of the season, the Patriots and the Steelers. They've already both got two losses on the season. Now you play Pittsburgh, a team who's got plenty of self-scouting to do. They've got to do a lot of looking in the mirror and figuring out what's wrong with them. And now on top of that, you got to get ready for perhaps the best team in the NFL.
Yeah, that's the other side of it. And I watched their game live because we played Sunday night, and that game was a noon game in Houston, so I got to watch every snap. And, wow, I mean, they're searching. And I know that they'll come in with tons of pride. They've been kryptonite for Arrowhead. Big Ben's had the Chiefs' number. It's actually been Le'Veon Bell more than Big Ben that's had the Chiefs' number. But I'm going to tell you, Nick, more than ever are they living off Le'Veon Bell. They're trying to get him the ball every way imaginable, every time. Yeah, they'll try to get it done on Antonio Brown, but Ben Roethlisberger is struggling so much on downfield throws. Brown could be open, and he's not going to get the ball. I think that's part of his frustration. It is somewhat reminiscent of what I saw with Peyton Manning in 2015. You remember that game at Mile High, mm-hmm. where the Chiefs held into 11 straight possessions where it was either 6 3 and outs or 5 picks. I think Osweiler had one of those. But it was weird. It was like, this ain't even the same guy. I mean, Roethlisberger really struggled against Jacksonville. And then the other thing that got your attention was defensively. Now, this Pittsburgh defense is very similar in their approach to the Denver defense. Not quite as good, but not bad, because they're kind of a front-running defense. They're like a team like West Virginia in basketball, where if they turn you over a couple times, it is a feeding frenzy. Well, here's Jacksonville. Jacksonville threw the ball 14 times in an NFL game. They ran the ball 12 straight times, either with Leonard Fournette or with Chris Ivory, and Pittsburgh could not stop them with the game on the line. Now, you just talk about taking a team's spirit away. That's exactly what happened to Pittsburgh. So that's why they've got issues here. I think the two teams are drastically different than the two teams that played in January in the playoffs in Arrowhead.
He's the voice of the Chiefs. Mitch Holt is joining us here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. And I say this with a heavy heart, Mitch, but for the first time this season, you personally are coming into this week with an L on the resume. You took a tough one last week. Life prep, and I'm imagining you've lost some sleep over that.
Yeah, I haven't slept a wink since then, actually. I could not sleep in Houston. I was squirming around. And, you know, Life Prep is a neat Christian school in Wichita, I think.
Yep.
And you would think, well, they wouldn't gloat over it. You know, God's opposed to the proud because grace to the humble. And I've been taunted by him, like, man, it's fire, it's fire. You said flame, it's fire. It's just like the assistant pastor at my church in Kansas City, he's a South, you know, he's a Buffalo from Sunrise Christian, and won't let me forget that that's one of my four losses in 3 years. So, yeah, I mean, you nailed me, man. You called Ollie for a finesse. You're going, how am I going to get him? He goes, put Life Prep in there. So I'm a wounded animal, just like Pittsburgh.
All right, well, let's see if you can bounce back. I have a feeling that you're going to be reinvigorated today as we see what's on the docket. 83-1, first up, Centralia High School.
Centralia Panthers, and it's not just Centralia, it's also Corning. The old Corning Lions, Kelly, is a kind of a parochial school out in the middle of a cornfield. They all go to Centralia, and they bring it. Also best known, and KU fans will love it, John Riggins, Pro Football Hall of Famer from Centralia. But they've had some other folks. Now, you've also saddened my heart because the Smith Center Redmen, the 79-game winning streak, mm-hmm. that's the state's longest of all time, was ended by the Centralia Panthers in the 2A state championship in Hayes when Colt Rogers fumbled in overtime and Centralia broke the streak.
Logan High School.
The Logan Trojans, they too have had fantastic tradition down through the years, not far from my hometown. The Kempers were good players. Marcus Kemper was a stud basketball player. Now they're playing co-op eight-man football. They've joined with the Palco Roosters to have the Logan Palco Trojans. Palco still plays basketball, but Logan's got some great tradition there. Also home of the Dane G. Hansen Museum, which is on your bucket list to visit sometime.
Okay, so we'll get Kirstie Alley, Aaron Brockovich, you, me. We'll bring the son of the Alamo, Bruce Collinsworth, and we'll go on our Kansas tour later this year.
He'll bring the pizza. He also has his hovercraft now that he's got parked out back of 9th and Mississippi at Papa John's. If people, I shouldn't even say it, if they know right where to look, they'll see his new 22nd century hovercraft. It's pretty cool. We can, you know, we're going to Dodge City, Garden City, too, for that game.
Right.
But it seats, well, we need five. You, me, Kirstie, Aaron, him. Yeah, it seats five. We're good to go.
Perfect. All right, Jackson Heights High School.
The Cobras. 2A team that's got to, you got to keep an eye out for these guys and gals. The guys in football, coached by Smith Center Redmen alum Caleb Wick. Now, if you're at Jackson Heights, here's the big note about them. It's the only school in the state of Kansas. Not even the Chesky Lions or the Firebirds can say this. It is an old missile silo from the Cold War.
Wow.
They took an old missile silo that was there to make sure that, you know, for the Russian threat, said, let's make a school out of this, and that's Jackson Heights High School. So Circleville, gosh, is it, I'm trying to think of the other towns. Whiting, there's a bunch of little towns that make up Jackson Heights. But, hey, if you're going to go to school, you might as well go to school in a old missile silo.
All right, last one, Natoma High School.
The Natoma Tigers, best known for producing John Locke, who was a Hall of Fame coach, and he had like 10 sons, and they were all stud players. And all, I think, went to Fort Hays State and played basketball there. But they kind of borrowed KU's cheer because they would have Rock Chalk John Locke is what they would say, and Johnny Locke could coach some ball. They were really good in the mid-70s. Man, they were loaded. And then they had Doug Finch, who was one of the fastest players at the time in 1A, who later became the father of Smith Center Lady Red sharpshooter Dana Finch, who became Creighton's all-time three-point shooter.
Mitch, you go 4-0 this week. It's a ninth bounce back, but I did just hear police sirens in the background, and I just want to remind you that I know how much you love that Papa John's pizza, but you're not supposed to be eating and driving at the same time. So I would advise against that.
Actually, they pulled me over and said, do you have any pizza in there? Because I could smell it as they drove by. I thought, that's a little weird. But I said, yes, 9th and Mississippi. And they said, well, we'll check. Just be careful next time and give us your pizza. I go, okay, officer, here it is.
Confiscating the goods. Mitch Holt is bringing it
9th
every week.
9th in Mississippi.
That's right.
9th in Mississippi. Pizza and hovercraft. Bruce Collinsworth.
Appreciate the time, Mitch.
See you, brother.
Well, Jesse, on Saturday, that loss that KU suffered at the hands of Texas Tech pretty much erased any conversations we were having about the offensive improvement or how KU can kind of move along and right the ship defensively, because that loss on Texas Tech, I'm sure it won't go down as the most disappointing loss in KU football history, but of this current era of KU football, that was about as disheartening of a loss as I can remember.
Yeah, I think what makes it worse, if you're looking at it from a KU football fan standpoint, is just the circumstances surrounding it. You know, I know I was one of the people that picked KU to win this game in the offseason. Like, I thought, okay, Texas Tech, kind of one of those down teams in the Big 12, KU coming off a bye week. So you look, KU coming off a bye on homecoming, had shown some positive signs the previous game against West Virginia, a 15-point underdog coming in, and then you lose by 46. And like you said, completely get outgunned defensively. I think I have to look up again, but it was a top five, I think it was maybe third or second most points given up by a Power 5 defense this year. That's a really bad number, letting a Texas Tech team run all over you, which had not had success running the football. And then, like you said, a huge step back for the offense, which had found some answers, it seemed like, in the running game previous weeks. And I wrote about it in my story. I mean, the one thing that this season, even though it's kind of been a disaster for KU football, the one thing it didn't have was a quarterback controversy. And KU kind of circling back to, is it this guy or that guy? And now back to square one with that, where KU sort of has, okay, is it this guy or that guy going into the next week? So, yeah, it's disappointing from so many aspects if you're a KU football fan looking at this. And, again, I'll just put the bottom line. The bottom line is you're a 15-point underdog. You lose by 46. I mean, anytime that sort of thing happens, you can tell that that was not an effort that KU's coaching staff should be proud of.
And that was coming off a bye week. And yesterday at his press conference, David Beatty said, you know, we liked the game plan. We just didn't execute. So how much of what you saw defensively, and if you want to talk offense too as well, do you chalk up to just poor execution by KU?
Yeah, I actually wrote a blog about this. I'd encourage people to check out online earlier this week on KansasCity.com. But I went over KU's the first three touchdowns for Texas Tech. I went over it with the Division I assistant coach, who stays anonymous just so he can kind of talk openly about, you know, what happens on each play. And it's sort of difficult to figure out because, you know, you can pinpoint things. Like, for example, on one touchdown run, Josh Ahambe went to the wrong gap. They were blitzing from the outside. He goes to the C gap along with Mike Lee, who's blitzing, and that leaves the B gap open. The 47-yard touchdown run for Texas Tech. So something like that, that's miscommunication. That's not being in the right place. You look at another play where Tyrone Miller, KU's playing cover two, and for some reason he charges up 15 yards ahead of where he should be. He should let no receiver get behind him, and he let a receiver get basically 12 yards behind him into the end zone. So again, miscommunication, not talking right. But the problem even with that analysis is it even comes short of pinning the blame on coaching staff or players or communication. I mean, it's really difficult because, okay, does Josh Ahambe, did he not know to go to the right gap because he didn't get the play call right, because he didn't remember the play call, because he just forgot in the heat of the moment, or because he wasn't taught well? So it's, even then it's really hard to know. Like, same thing for Tyrone Miller. Did he get a late play call because Texas Tech was running tempo? Did he just forget the play call? Did he not remember what he was doing? I mean, all those sorts of things, you're not really sure exactly what went wrong. But I think what David Beatty was saying, and this is what I took from him talking about Clint Bowen yesterday, was saying KU didn't get beat by alignment a lot. If you look back at some of those plays, a lot of times if you have, let's say you're running it to the right, and you have six blockers and KU has five guys, well, that's a coaching staff mistake. You know what I mean? You got to have guys aligned in the right spot, because if you have six blockers and five guys to block, it's going to be a touchdown, or it's going to be a very successful play because of how the guys are aligned. Those three plays I looked at, there wasn't much of that. It was more like guys were in the wrong spot, even though, you know, it wasn't KU didn't have enough guys on the left side or the right side. It was guys were not in the right position to make the plays. And so, again, it makes it very difficult to assign blame here and know exactly who to point the finger at with what's going wrong. But at the same point, there's so many mistakes that are being made right now. It seems like it's going to be a little bit longer to fix than maybe 1 or 2 weeks.
It does kind of seem like a team that's a little bit stuck in the mud, because at least, you know, after Central Michigan or after Ohio, yes, those were disappointing losses as well. But we sat here and we said, okay, the offense still is way better than it's been in years past. And with only being a couple games into the season, you can talk about improvement and these guys are going to get better. But now, you know, giving up 121 points in your first two conference games, it does seem hard to imagine a ton of improvement being made from here on out, knowing that you came off a bye and knowing that this has kind of been the theme now through five games of the season.
Yeah, it's difficult too with the offense, because again, that was kind of what you pointed to say, hey, this KU team is better in one area for sure. And KU really didn't get the running game going. You know, they're injured at running back with Khalil Herbert and Dom Williams both kind of battling some nagging things, so you don't know how long they're going to be out or whether they'll be out there this week against Iowa State. But again, we mentioned this before, one of the most troubling things that happened is just that KU is looking to its backup quarterback again. And there were those red zone throws in the second and third and goal late in the second quarter that basically got Peyton Bender pulled from the game, that you can see where Doug Meacham could be upset. You could see where he'd be frustrated. You know, you look at those two plays, and they're going to work if they're executed well. Like, they did exactly what KU wanted the Texas Tech defense to do, that left a wide-open receiver, and it's one of those intermediate throws that doesn't have to be too perfect, but, you know, Peyton Bender basically sails both of them out of the side of the end zone, doesn't even give his teammate a chance to make a play. And, again, I have no inside knowledge of this. I don't know exactly the conversations that happened, but I could just see Doug Meacham probably getting to a point at halftime saying, I schemed up these plays. They should have worked. It's not a difficult throw. Peyton Bender doesn't even give it a chance. I want to see what the next guy has. Like, I'm just so mad right now that I can't see this guy going back into the game. Now, I mean, they've talked this week. Hey, they know who the starter is going to be. The team knows. They're not going to announce it because David Beatty wants to keep it a secret. You know, whatever. That's fine. But the thing is, I would guess they're going back to Peyton Bender because you've seen flashes of him to be one of KU's best quarterbacks, you know, especially since they lost Todd Reesing back in 2009. But I don't think you want to kill his confidence. I don't think you want to have a situation where you're rotating guys in and out and don't know who to go to. But I guess we'll see him moving forward. I understand the frustration, especially if you're an offensive coordinator, especially if you do everything all week to get two receivers wide open in the end zone and not come away with a touchdown in that situation. But I think for the long game here, that the KU needs to stick with one and just go with that guy, because otherwise you kind of have this musical chair scenario, and to be honest, it has not worked for Kansas in the last 2 years.
Well, specifically with Bender, I mean, the numbers, you can't really argue against him with what he did through the first couple of games of the season. That was his worst performance, I would imagine. That's a pretty consensus decision there on Saturday against Texas Tech. Like, what are the shortcomings with him that you see that are leading to perhaps a lack of confidence from the fans and certainly the coaching staff?
Well, I think for Peyton, he has good quarters and then he has bad quarters. And, you know, David Beatty after the Texas Tech game talked about command. And, you know, it's funny, I don't really think about command when it comes to a quarterback. You know, it's not something I've really considered before. But if you think about baseball, I mean, sometimes those relief pitchers that throw 100, you bring them in and, you know, one game they come in and their curveball's working and their fastball's on the corner and like nobody touches him. But then like Dylan Stances, you bring him in the next game and he doesn't know where the heck the strike zone is and he's sailing it to the backstop. I mean, I almost feel like Peyton Bender is KU's Dylan Stances, because there's quarters where he guns it and he hits Steven Sims in stride and it looks pretty and he's hitting guys in the intermediate routes that you know, are getting him in the right spots. And I mean, I think that he's had good quarters and he's had good moments. It's just that when he loses it, he loses it. I still remember a couple of weeks ago, Doug Meacham talked about one throw, an end zone throw. It's very similar to that third down play in the red zone that KU had against Texas Tech. And he said for Peyton, it was the equivalent of throwing a layup attempt over the backboard. You know, he kind of just said, I don't know where that came from. Like, how can you throw that ball? How can you miss that badly when the guy's standing right there, not that far from you? So, you know, with Peyton, I think he's making the right reads. I think he's doing things in the offense they want him to do and going to, you know, first guy, second guy, third guy. His eyes are in the right spot. It's just the execution of it has been so poor at times. I think Doug Meacham just had enough. He's like, man, if I'm scheming this play, and even if your eyes are in the right spot, if you sail it into those end zone seats when the guy is standing wide open in the end zone, I can't have you in there anymore. So, again, we'll see where KU goes from here, but I almost think that's probably a positive sign. I mean, as bad as KU's quarterback play has been, and it's at the bottom of the Big 12 and ESPN QBR, like it's been for the past basically 7 or 8 years, again, I still think Peyton Bender, at least eyes in the right spot, looking at the right receivers, it feels like that might be even a little bit better than what they've had in the past. And if you give him the chance, he has had some good moments. So I guess if I was KU, I would stick with him and just see how far he could take him.
We're talking to Jesse Newell of the Kansas City Star here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Jesse, as I'm sure you saw earlier today, NCAA President Mark Emmert announced the formation of a commission on college basketball. They are going to crack down on all of the cheaters, on all of the do-no-gooders, on all this culture of silence, as Mark Emmert referred to it in this statement. It's going to be headed by Condoleezza Rice and several notable figures, including Grant Hill, Notre Dame president John Jenkins, David Robinson, the Admiral is going to be on here. What do you make of this, the NCAA, at least from my vantage point, essentially accepting no responsibility, and now they're going to crack down on all of this shady business that's going on in the sport?
The three letters that come to mind are CYA, and I know I probably can't say it on radio, but to spell it out. But, yeah, I mean, when this whole thing comes down and there's an FBI investigation, all that stuff, I mean, if you're the NCAA, if you want to remain in charge of these athletes and keep the amateurism going and all those sorts of things, it seems like this is what you do. You at least give the appearance that you're taking these allegations and some of the stuff that's happened in college basketball very seriously. So, again, I don't. What do you think you're going to find from that? What do you think it's going to produce? I don't know, if anything. But it seems to me like, at least from a publicity standpoint, that the NCAA is trying to step up and at least give the appearance that they are taking this very seriously and not just letting the FBI or the district attorney of New York or whoever. I mean, not just letting them have their free will and do those things and then completely ignore what the results and the findings are. It's the NCAA trying to at least give the appearance that it's trying to get out in front of some of these problems in college athletics. I can't imagine we'll go very far. I can't imagine that we'll hear much about it in the next few months, years, or whatever, but it's probably the stance the NCAA has to take just so that it looks like it is concerned about what's going on here. But again, there was plenty of time earlier on to maybe make a little bit more of an impact or to do this sort of thing. It seems like with the timing of what's happened, it's more of a reactive measure than a proactive measure. I think we all can agree.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm surprised. Like, I don't know why I hear this and say, really? Like, this is what you're going to spend your time doing? Because it does seem like a wasted effort. But at this juncture, I guess expecting, like, progressive ideas to try and get out ahead of this and make college basketball better for all involved, including the players, that's probably my naivete playing a factor there.
Yeah, well, and we'll see where it goes. I mean, maybe there'll be some good coming out of it, but it just seems to me like, again, all this stuff happens, the negative publicity that comes out, and it seems like the NCAA did nothing. Then we would all talk about why they aren't stepping up to the plate once there were some very serious allegations that came out against them. So this seems like the natural step. You come out with a committee, you put some big-time names on there that people can recognize and understand, and then you see what you can find, I guess. So we'll see what happens over the next few months. But again, it's like everything else. It's sort of a wait and see at this moment just to see where all this leads us in the next few months and even years.
He's Jesse Newell of the Kansas City Star. I'm Nick Schwartz. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I know we've still got, a little over 3 weeks away, I believe, from the start of college basketball season when KU will kick off their exhibition play. When you look at this team, and we talk about it all off season long, and we've talked about it really for the past 3 years, playing big versus playing small, and last week we talked about Billy Preston and his role in kind of dictating what the identity of this team is going to be. And just as much as Billy Preston, even though it's not going to be as marquee of a role, Mitch Lightfoot seems like a guy who what he's capable of is going to be go a long ways towards determining what KU is able to do, because regardless of what your expectations are for him or what kind of player you think he is, like, he is going to be called on to play some significant minutes simply because, I mean, he's your third big. He's your last big, and you know they're not going to be able to survive on two alone. What are realistic expectations for Lightfoot here in year number two for him?
It's a great question. I think it's – I was having a conversation on Twitter with Dan Hanner, and he, along with the SI guys, they do – great projections for the college basketball season, some of the numbers-based things. And every single year they have one of the top ranked in terms of accuracy when it comes to college basketball polls. So we were talking about the big versus small for KU, and it's fascinating because Bill Self on the late-night podcast on Spectrum Sports talked about how he wants to play, or he envisioned KU playing 70% big, 30% small this year. And Hanner's projections have KU playing 45% small and 55% big this year. And so I'm interested to hear Bill Self talk about this because even optimistically, if you put optimistic minutes, I mean, I think it's real tough to envision a scenario where KU plays 75% big because, you know, you look at the three big guys. You look at Udoka Azubuike. Okay, he was injured last year. Can he stay healthy a full season? He's had the foul issues. He also has had conditioning issues in the past. Now, I know his weight is down, but still, how many minutes realistically can he play? I mean, that's a big dude running up down the court. And you got Billy Preston, there's going to be that constant battle. We talked about my article from a week ago where KU and Bill Self want him to play inside, and he has tried to kind of steer back out to the outside, which is what he's played his whole life. And we've seen past examples of KU freshmen, big men under Bill Self, taking a while to figure it all out. So there's questions with that, and there's always questions with freshmen about fouling. So, again, that leaves Mitch Lightfoot. That's the only other big there. And I know he had the mask on in Italy, but he had a rough go of it in those four games. Tough to catch passes. Again, that could be the mask he was wearing, but they're going to need minutes from him, especially if KU wants to go big. So, yeah, I'm fascinated by Mitch Lightfoot, too, just because it seems like if Bill Self is playing big like he wants to, the 70% number, that would leave Mitch Lightfoot a lot of minutes if you're trying to add that math out and figure out what's happening. So, you know, either he's made a big jump and that's going to happen, or, you know, KU finds out very early on that maybe he isn't ready for prime time and they go more to a small ball lineup. But I think right now you've kind of hit on one of the big storylines of the offseason, which is KU went small last year, had lots of success. Part of the reason had Josh Jackson, who could be very versatile. What happens this year? I mean, how are they going to handle that big versus small debate? And how much is Bill Self willing to give up defensively if he is going to be able to go small and play those four guards together, which could be a very, very, very dangerous offensive lineup?
Because you can envision the scenario right now, like early season, Bill Self's given the small ball lineup a shot, and then all of a sudden, whoever it is in there, if it's LeGerald Vick or Svi or whoever else you want to throw out there, they're getting torched down low defensively. Bill Self's frustrated on the sideline. He's screaming. He's going to the bench, pulling in Mitch Lightfoot. And even though from a talent standpoint, you wouldn't throw him up there with Vick, I see this kid playing 15 to 20 minutes a game. Maybe that's a little bit much, but as you can go back through the years, and there have been guys who KU fans maybe didn't want to see out there as much as anybody else, whether it's Jamari Traylor or other big guys even before that. But this is going to be another one of those instances where he may trade that productivity for just somebody who can do the little things defensively that he wants to see down low.
Yeah, it's funny. After watching Bill Self for so long, it's like we're trying to weigh his vices, or not his vices, his pet peeves against each other, because you're right. I could very easily see a scenario where one team gets three offensive rebounds because KU doesn't have, you know, many rebounders in the game when it plays small, and so he throws in Mitch Lightfoot. I can also see the other side of it where Mitch Lightfoot gets a pass in the post, can't hold on to it, it falls out of bounds. We've seen this. I mean, this is the Cliff Alexander example, you know what I mean? Or something like that happens, and he immediately gets put on the bench because there's two or three other big men he can put in there. But the depth is going to test Bill Self as to which thing he's more willing to stomach. You know what I mean? I hate to put it that way in kind of a negative context, but that is kind of the thing you're going to be looking for throughout the season is Bill Self going to be able to stomach more the poor post defense from guys like, again, they got to go against like a Reed Travis who dominated KU last year in the post. If he's the true four man, are you going to have LeGerald Vick go against him and then just completely try to burn him on the other end, having Reed Travis guard LeGerald Vick? Is that the way you're going to play it? Or, again, you put Mitch Lightfoot in there, cost you some offense, but you just hope defensively he can hold up and then hope that he doesn't make too many mistakes offensively, just kind of be a role player, sort of like a Landon Lucas was a year ago. So, again, these two conflicting things will kind of be going at each other. Bill Self, usually with the depth that he recruits, doesn't have to worry about that. He can kind of get what he wants out of guys. But this year's just going to be a little bit different to see how he handles having 9 scholarship players and 8 when it comes to the first few months of the season before the second semester when Sam Cunliffe becomes available.
Because I can envision a scenario where, I don't know how likely it is, but I can envision the scenario where Udoka Azubuike is everything you expect and more, and he can be just a physical dominating presence defensively, and he gives Bill Self everything he wants, and you can kind of use that as a luxury to play more small ball. But at the end of the day, like going back to the conditioning thing, like is Udoka Azubuike legitimately going to give you 25, 30 minutes a game? Like maybe, but based off what we saw in a really, really limited sample size last year, that's a pretty big limb to walk out on as far as how much you can count on him to give you game by game.
Well, and let's go with that optimistic projection, because I'm glad you brought that up. Let's say he goes 25 minutes, and I think that's an optimistic projection for Udoka with the fouls, with the injury past, maybe a fluke injury last year, but then also his conditioning. Okay, so he gets 25. Well, okay, those other 15 minutes he's not in, you got to have a big man. So you would think Billy Preston slides over to the 5 in those instances. And so, again, how many minutes are you projecting for Billy Preston? Okay, so let's say, what's an optimistic projection for him? 30? Would 30 be optimistic? Would that not quite be optimistic?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so 30 minutes, he's playing 15 with Udoka, and 15 when Udoka's out of the game. Again, this is assuming no one's in foul trouble and no one's hurt by conditioning. Okay, so then you're getting yourself, okay, so 15 minutes they play together, that's 15 out of 40. That's not, 70% small ball. That would require, okay, now you're going to go back to the optimistic prediction for Mitch Lightfoot. You're going to have to put him in there, the 15-ish, 20 minutes. With another big man. And so, again, these numbers, if we're all going on the optimistic end of this, it's still very difficult for KU to get 70% big. So, again, I'm fascinated to hear what Bill Self says about this, just to see kind of where he stands right now. I'll tell you what, in Italy, that last game when they played the four small ball, I know the competition wasn't good, but, man, the ball was moving. Those guys were creating for each other. They have such dangerous shooters. That could be a dynamite offensive offensive team. I'm telling you, those four guys, Vic, Svi Mykhailiuk, Malik Newman, Devontae Graham around, Kazubuki. I mean, that could be a crazy, crazy good offensive lineup. And again, we'll see. I mean, there's been teams in the past that succeed playing that way. I remember Duke a couple years ago where their defense was like 120th in efficiency, but number one offensively. And so, again, I don't know if Bill Self would ever commit to playing that way, but I guess I'm fascinated to find out because KU might be forced into it at some point this season.
He's Jesse Newell. You can check out all of his work in the Kansas City Star and at kansascity.com. Also, check out KUHoops.com while you're on there. Jesse, always appreciate the time, man.
All right, sounds good, Nick.